Hello, and welcome to the Tommyknocker Tapes. The Tommyknocker Tapes are podcast interviews of Creed Repertory Theater's resident and guest artists, with the main focus being on practical, useful advice for the actor from diverse points of view. In this podcast, Creed Rep's artistic director, Maurice LeMay, and I sit down with Mandy Patinkin. While Mandy should need no introduction, suffice it to say that he is a Tony winner, an Emmy winner, and part of what has become a cult favorite film, just to mention a few highlights. In this podcast, Mandy touches on theater as a holy place, his personal preparation technique, and some insightful tidbits that were told to him by his Zen Buddhist monk brother-in-law. So I'm here at the top of Tommyknocker Tavern with Mandy Patinkin, and Mandy, I want to start off by asking you pretty much the same question I ask everybody. I want, from your point of view, I guess, having worked extensively in theater, film, and television, can you tell me whether or not theater is still as vital as it might have been when there was no theater and film or television, or are we now sort of like the redheaded stepchild of the performing arts? Does it still retain its vitality that it once had?
For me, the theater is the holy place. It's the holy ground for me. There's nothing purer or rawer than being in the theater at that moment with whatever happened that day in the world at that second, and being with a congregation of people that are affecting each other in the way the performers perform for them, how they hear it, what they send back, and the give and take of that. Just the other day, we went to the Creed Repertory Theater to see Lullaby Bay, the new children's show. It was a dress rehearsal because we weren't able to get tickets for the performance. It was sold out. And it just was so thrilling. These were children. It was a children's show. They did everything. It was, first of all, it took me back to how I began here with, they made the props, the scenery, they worked on their costumes, they put it all together themselves the way we used to. And then they did this simple, beautiful little story. And at one point, there's an extremely magical effect when they go underwater. And I live in New York City, and we have privy to all the fancy productions that come there because we go see them, and like anybody who goes through New York can go do. And I remember a few years ago, there was a very famous underwater show. Puppets underwater in a big water tank. Got a lot of attention from all the critics and was a big success. This little children's show at this theater left it in the dust.
Really?
It was so simple, so beautiful, so magical. It just did everything that, for me, the theater asks you as the audience to do, which is to use your imagination to go somewhere else in this odd black space where the lights are framing moments in time and take a ride. But do your work sitting there as an audience. Don't go to the fridge and get a beer like you do when you're on watching TV. Don't go buy some more Junior Mints or get some more popcorn for your girlfriend when you're watching a movie, because somebody will tell you what happened that you just missed. You don't move. And on top of it, there were children doing it. So it was right back to not just when I was 17 or 18 when I was here in 1971 for the first time, but it talked to the child in the 54-year-old me and in the 86-year-old somebody sitting next to me. As a friend of mine said, which I think the theater ignites in people, he said, what you want to be, and this is a little off the topic, but I love his sentiment. He said, what you feel when you're 21, you want to feel when you're 31, that freedom that you can do anything, imagine anything, realize anything, which to me is what the theater's essence is about, what you wish for yourself and for the world and how you realize those wishes. This friend of mine says, that's that quality that most 18, 21-year-olds have, that there's nothing they can't do, realize or imagine, and see to fruition, is what you want to have when you're 31, 41, 51, 61, 81, 91, and 101. And so there's nothing better than the theater for me. I try to stay alive with it while I'm earning a living for the family, doing other things by the concert stage, which I stay a part of, And work with people like I just put a new piece together for Patti LuPone and myself. And when you're up there with people that are, I mean, whenever I see Patti perform, when I stand back and watch her perform, which is much larger than life, in many cases, like she, like me, is larger than the camera wants to see. But the theater loves it.
Right.
Because the theater's lens is the audience's eyes. And their positioning is not a 50 millimeter lens. It varies. And they have peripheral vision as opposed to the camera's lens. So when I watch someone like Patti perform, or these children perform, this little boy in this play, these other actors in this children's play in Creed, Colorado, I'm moved beyond expression. I can't believe the magic of it. And it inspires me continually to try to find my way back in and never forget that's where I was born.
So you have, in the course of your career, managed to have picked up a Tony and an Emmy. So I'm assuming that you're doing something right. My question for you is, what is your preparation for a show, be it theater, television, or film, and do they differ depending on the medium? How do you specifically prepare?
Well, I just got a call from my 81-year-old mentor and teacher, Gerald Friedman, who I met at Juilliard, who is going to be in L.A. while I have to go back to work. We're going to have dinner a week from tonight. 2 years ago, I think, or three or four, I can't remember, 3 years ago or something, we got back together again after God knows how many years since school, and we did Ibsen's Enemy of the People at Williamstown, Massachusetts,
yes,
which I just loved because of the language, the ideas. I'm working in television. Television is an economic medium as far as I'm concerned. Occasionally it has moments that are of gifts, but in general it's not as fertile a ground as the theater, because of the attention span, or I should say lack of it in television and availability to it in the theater.
Right.
When you work on something like Ibsen, and you've been at the same time working on a TV show, you can't believe what's in a sentence, let alone a paragraph, in terms of idea, ideology, etc. So how do you go about connecting to that material and then delivering the author's intention, the director's intention, the other artists, actors' intentions, in terms of what story are we trying to tell today? How do I do that? And I go back to what Jerry Friedman taught me when I was 19, 20 years old at school at Juilliard. I remember Bill Hurt and I, William Hurt, he likes to be called William, I know him as Bill. William sat on Jerry's right, I sat on Jerry's left. We were working on The Duchess of Malfi. I was playing Boslo, Bill was playing Ferdinand. And Jerry was trying to get us to understand what was an action. I did a scene, you know, he said, get up and do the scene. I did the scene. He said, now what did you do? I said, I did the scene. He said, I know you did the scene. What were you doing in the scene? I said, the scene, what I was supposed to be doing. I understand, but can you tell me what you were doing? I guess not, I said. He said, no, I guess you can't. He said, could you do it 8 times a week? I said, I guess. You guess, he said. Well, what, should I hire you if you guess you could do it 8 times a week? That's not very helpful to me. That's not very confidence building to me. He said, I'd like to know what you were doing. I'd like you to know what you were doing. I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, let's see if we can figure it out. And then I started writing sentences, paragraphs of what I was doing in this scene. All these incredible 18-year-old wisdom, you know, gifts that I was giving this teacher of mine of what I was doing. And Bill, who was always much smarter than myself, he had it rather quickly. And Jerry was trying to get me to write not paragraphs, not a sentence, but a single word. I.e., I'm trying to hold you as a listener. I'm trying to arrest you. I'm trying to shock you. I'm welcoming you. I invite you. I'm lost. I freeze. I listen. And I look for these words. And as my life as an actor goes on and as a singer, those word triggers, which I would synthesize down to a single word, always is the single goal, which is to connect. So when Steve Sondheim and James Lapine in Sunday in the Park with George wrote the continual theme, connect, George, connect, it became the theme for my life, that idea of connect. So, for instance, If I'm doing a scene with you and it's for a movie or television show or even a play and we're murdering someone, or it's a violent act, and it's filled with man's inhumanity to man. Let's say I've had a, thank God, blessed life where I haven't had to experience such horror. I haven't had to be in a war. I haven't had to see a violent act in my neighborhood. And thank God, you know, knock on wood, that, you know, that hasn't been my lot.
Right.
But I'm an actor. I have to play that. How do I do that? What do I do? Well, I am a human being. I've been out in the world for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, however old I am, 20 years, 54 years now. I read, I see, I've heard about things in the world. Some things I've seen in images, some things in books, some things from tales. Some of those things that I've heard that are both personal experiences in my life and foreign experiences that I've just absorbed hit nerves in my soul. They become my personal triggers, my personal connections, my personal vocabulary to the work, to the window into the work. And I access them sometimes quicker than other times. I was comforted by this work once, when I was at Stephen Sondheim's house, and who I get to work with, thank God, a lot. And on his piano are scraps and notes of paper from envelope backings of envelopes and just garbage paper with lists of words. And those words are pared down, sometimes two or three, sometimes one, and he's looking for couplets or rhymes, but he's also looking for intention. And those lists just go down to the simplest word. And it was identical to what Jerry Friedman was trying to teach me. And I bring this journey for how to connect and how to find that action to a simple close that I was just talking about with friends and my wife on a hike. I said, you know, Catherine, because somebody said, who are my greatest teachers? And I said, and my wife, Catherine Grody, gave me one of my greatest gifts. I was doing a play, I think at the time it was, what was that thing called? The Secret Garden. It was a musical that we did. And I knew what I was doing, but I do my work. And somebody said, well, why, don't you work too hard sometimes in terms of all this background work and these actions? Can't you work too hard if you know it? Absolutely, you can work too hard. I'm so worried, though, I'm a worrier, that I'd rather work too hard so that if on the day that I'm on stage singing a song, doing the play, in front of the camera, in front of the microphone, whatever I'm doing, that if I suck, it's not because I didn't try to prepare.
Right.
It's not my fault. On the other hand, sometimes all of that preparation can interfere with my freedom. Mm-hmm. And so it might make me suck. And I'll tell you two things. One, my wife said, which was to me one of the great lessons. I was all nervous, and I think it was opening night or something for this play. And I'd done all this work, and I couldn't get my head straight, or I was dizzy or tired or just frightened. And I couldn't remember my actions or the scene or what am I doing or what's that simple thing that runs through the core of it all. Because I look for that nerve that runs through the center, whether it's the director's arc, pull back that arrow and shoot it through the core, whether it's what the writer's doing or what the actor does. And eventually, I think, for many artists, painters, writers, musicians, you'll see that arrow go through their work for their life. And I said to my wife, I said, I can't find it. She said, Mandy, you know this work. You've done this work. You know it. You know this man. You know these situations. You know this work. Forget about it and just go out there, listen to the words and see where they take you. It's the hardest thing in the world to do, but I think it's the smartest lesson. And we just watched, because we didn't get Dish Satellite up here at the mountain, so we just watched an old movie of Rosemary's Baby. And on those DVDs, you know how they have the extras? So there's an extra of an interview from, I don't know, 1960-something, and Roman Polanski was being interviewed about Mia Farrow, who I think was 19 or 21 at the time. And he said about her, which to me, I would love to try to achieve before I die, and I think it's like climbing Everest. What is so brilliant about Mia, he said at that young age, was that she was completely, she had the ability as an actress, and this is what Polanski said he looked for in an actor, the ability to be completely relaxed and available, but totally concentrated. So totally relaxed to whatever might happen, but completely concentrated. So it's a little long answer to your simple question, but it's a complicated journey. And I think, you know, I was talking to Steve Quiller, a painter who lives in Creed. And just the other day he was talking about as though he'd hardly even begun, because he's trying to find in light and in his brush and his hand and his brain, how he can capture that light. And what I always think of for my life's work is, it's, and why I love Sondheim, it's because to me, what he does is take the darkness and turn it into light. That's what I try to do. And I was trying to write, and I'm not a writer. And so my writing, like many people who are new at their game, whether it be writing music or whatever, it was just overloaded as performances from actors and directors, writers, but overloaded. All my ideas were on the page. Too many stories. You couldn't find the forest through the trees or the trees through the forest. You couldn't find anything.
Too much.
And I remember this core nerve lesson that Jerry Friedman taught me, my teacher, that I always look for in my work. Is there that, what's that nerve that runs through it? So I was trying to write this thing, this story, this movie, this play, whatever it was. I couldn't find it. It was a mess because I had so many things going on. I called Rob Reiner up, who I'd done a movie called The Princess Bride with. And I said, Rob, I hear what I'm trying to write, and I have this, I believe in this lesson that there's this nerve that runs through our work. And I can't, and so I was thinking of The Princess Bride. I said, how on earth would, and it's such a wonderful story, how on earth would you put that in one sentence, for God's sake? And say that, what's that nerve? And he didn't even hesitate. He said, that's simple. It's about a little boy who's sick in Evanston, Illinois. His grandfather comes over to read him a book to tell him the most important thing in life is true love. And if you think about that movie and that story, yeah, every frame of that movie, no matter which character you're looking at, that's their battleground. They are fighting, every one of them, for true love. To the most, the smallest part of some ensemble player to the largest part in the film. Every single one of them is trying to connect to their ability to see if they're capable of having true love.
But that's such an important thing. I just love it because it's it's the simplicity, I think what you're getting at is the simplicity. So often I see with younger actors wanting just to do too much, you know, instead of just getting to the very core, the very essence of it, and not doing any more than that.
Yes.
Because actually the doing more detracts from what it is that you're doing.
Yes, so much. I remember an actor, I was doing some little symposium somewhere, and these kids, that were in their 20s, but they prepared some things. And this one young lady was an extraordinarily gifted person, you could tell. But she was really performing the hell out of this thing. She had great comic ability, great chops, just performing. And I stopped when it was over, and I asked her, and we had 300 people in the audience, and I said, why did you pick this piece? Well, I like it, she said. I understand you like it. And all this, and I said, but why this piece? What about it? And she then began to talk about, and I said to her, it had mockeries of certain things about your background, your ethnicity, your the way you look, your femininity, etc. There were comments in the piece, but you mocked them, and you were entertaining about them, and you were large about them. She said, yes. I said, well, is it possible, and we talked more, and she said, I picked it, I guess, finally, because it affects me. It hurts me. I'm fighting what it's about. I said, oh. I said, so it's pretty personal. She said, yeah. I said, well, could you show us that for a moment before you entertain us? Could you not busy yourself so much with entertaining me? Mm-hmm. And let me understand why you chose this particular piece to do today. And she then stood there with more courage than I have ever had, in front of 300 people, and did those same words with almost nothing, in a kind of stillness that equals the wilderness. And it opened this door into her soul that arrested every single individual in that audience. It was thrilling, terrifying, and unbelievably generous that she showed us that. And when it became to the point of unbearability, she then entertained. And it was an extraordinary lesson to see, you know, because that's the work we all try to do. You can't see it when you're doing it. And you shouldn't be doing it in a mirror. So the theater's great gift to me, I think, is that you can't see your work. as opposed to becoming aware of your body, your language, your this, your that, from film or recording, whatever. You can't see it. So it requires another thing that is a lifelong journey for me, trust. Trust in what you don't understand, what you're not sure of, what the director's eyes might see, the other actor who's there or not, the audience's response, the silence or the laughter, the other unexplainable sounds that happen. It's a gift that we can't see ourselves. You don't watch yourself in life. Right. So the theater, to me, is holy for that reason.
So the other question I had, you've had the opportunity to work, as I said, with a long list of phenomenal performers. What about them for you? What for the ones that you hold highest, what makes them so great to perform and play with?
The really great ones make you arrive and instantly realize that you don't have to do anything but show up and listen. Because they're so full. Not of busyness or lack of simplicity, but of their willingness to share their feelings about life. Or how they artistically hide those feelings or whatever. But they're willing to share their artistry. And when you walk down the road and work with lots of people, there are people that you see here, even in a children's play, let alone Bill Kulke, who was a teacher when I was at KU, and you watch him, that their gift is unexplainable. I said to a young person who was a gifted musician recently, look, I understand that you don't have the chops. You don't know how to read exactly music yet, or you may not know how to compose or this or that. But if you really want to go after the music, go to places that might have a variety of skills that you might want to compose or create or do this. It's just one avenue. You can never take a lesson your whole life and become, the greatest musician ever. Right. But what I was trying to say to him is, because their schools are filled with people who can do what I refer to as the idiot work, the breathing work, the movement work, the speech work, the tongue work to make your mouth work, all the physical things that are good to have as an artist. You need to get muscles in your brain and your body working, but you can't give someone the gift. And what is that gift? I think the gift is, it's just people in this lifetime that you read about, witness, or see on a day-to-day basis, if you're lucky, that connect to humanity or to the experience of humanity in their oversensitive way and reflect that connection back to the viewer in a selfless mirror that is a rare gift, because we're all trying to figure out, how do you make it okay in this life? How do you make the world better? How do you help the environment? Not make the planet go away? How do you help people stop killing each other? And if we're in a medium that is not an isolated medium, but where you come in contact with other human beings, it's your obligation. So to me, it's a political effort to sing a song or to act in a play. It's politics. And when I was a young actor, my wife's dearest friend was who she babysat for all his kids, and it was the person who had to approve me to marry my wife, actually, was Martin and Janet Sheen. The Sheens.
Oh, yeah.
And I was having lunch early on in life with my wife somewhere 30 years ago, and I said, well, I'm really not that political. This is before my wife taught me to be political and other people, and I became far more political, but I said, I'm really not that political, at a breakfast with Martin and my wife and his wife, Janet. And he went, what? I said, well, I guess I'm just not. I didn't even know what my parents were, Republican or Democrats. They were just members of the Sisterhood of the Men's Club at the synagogue. I really don't. He said, well, let me ask you this. Do you breathe? I said, yes. He said, well, Mandy, the air you breathe is political. And, in the time we live in today, with what's going on in the world, there's nothing that isn't political. When you go see a children's play, and forgive me for keep repeating this children's play, but it's in my bone right now, in my bones. When you see these children, there's one little boy, Matt, when his nature is just, hey, here I am. Yeah. Here I am. And I'll be patient while the other person's talking. This part of the story is going on. But as soon as they're done, and I really am interested in what they're saying, but I can't wait to tell you my next thought. and it's just overwhelming generosity with no ego, mm-hmm. negative ego.
Right.
And it's just what you wish for. For anyone you come in contact with. And if leaders of the world could do this and stop, you know, killing each other, it's, you know, you'd wish that little boy, could that little boy go out there? can you send him out as an emissary for peace? Because mm-hmm. you can't deny it. And you know there are children like that all over the world.
Right.
So when you're in a communication medium, whether it's radio, somebody listening on an iPod, doing a play or a movie thing, you know, you don't know. My feeling is, what I always say that keeps me going, you don't know what little kid's going to be listening where or what they're going to see in a painting or a piece of music. And they're going to go, oh, wow, you know, I never knew. I guess I could do that. Mm-hmm. And that little kid's going to become the next Martin Luther King Jr. or Jesus Christ or Moses or Robert Kennedy or Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Winston Churchill. That's how it works. It's not any more complicated. They're just little kids.
Right.
So you asked me about the people I work with.
Yes.
I would never dare to name one above another, because my great privilege in life is that mm-hmm. I've been able to work with so many of these kinds of gifted people that in some cases intimidate me, and in other cases that intimidation, in every case where they've intimidated me, mm-hmm. the nature of their nature has also allowed me to walk into their gift and grow. And they've been my teachers. And it's just, there's nothing more thrilling to me than these people. And they're everywhere. They're everywhere. Mm-hmm. The odd thing about the theater is it just puts a frame around it and lights it. So you can look at it for a rare period of time. You know, the other thing about the theater is a Zen Buddhist monk said to me once, why do we sit to meditate? Why is this our practice? What is that about? Mm-hmm. And he said, if you look at every animal in the animal kingdom, from the housefly, the smalls, to the rhinoceros, all of them sit still during a waking state, except for one. Man does not do that. But the theater asks the audience, at least, to try to sit still, not speak, and listen, and watch. And other places don't have that invitation to them. Level. And you're with other people. In Zen Buddhism, they suggest that you don't meditate alone, that you meditate with other people. If you can't meditate alone, they say. So I'm one of the luckiest guys in the world because all the people I get to work with. Mm-hmm. They're amazing. And at this age of 54, I work with a lot of young actors. Mm-hmm. By young, I mean anywhere from literally anywhere from 5 or 4 to 50. They're all considered young to me. And I'm overwhelmed particularly by the real youthful actors, by the real young ones who haven't let anything get in their way yet. They haven't learned enough to have anything be in their way. They're so available. They're just so natural. They're just filled with light in that little boy in Lullaby, the Bay. They just have no inhibitions. I'll never forget my own son in an elevator once until he was 2 years old. He always said hi to everybody, and they couldn't help but say hi. Mm-hmm. Then one day someone got in the elevator in New York City that wasn't in a good mood or something, mm-hmm. and I guess he didn't say hi back, and that little boy felt that confusion of why somebody wasn't saying hi back, and he learned a sad lesson that maybe you don't say hi to everybody. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's some people who don't want to be said hi to, and that was sad. So kids particularly are my greatest teachers today. I learn more from them. I study them because they haven't been encumbered yet. And when they're just got it, when they have that gift, I watch them because I can't do it. Mm. And I try to go like, what are you doing? What nothingness are you doing? Mm-hmm. Where do you get this freedom to just be? How is your mind not so cluttered like mine? Mm-hmm. How are you doing this? And sometimes, you know, one of the gifts of television is if it has success, you can be around this family of people for a longer period of time, and you can start to study them. It's one of the gifts of an acting school to me, where you're usually with 25 to 30 students for a concentrated period of time. Right. It's the same thing at Krieg Repertory Theater, where you have X amount of people together for a very intense, concentrated period of time. You can watch each other. You know, the great teachers always said to me, you don't learn anything from doing it, you learn from watching. It's sort of the opposite in most parts of life. Because while you're doing it, if you're doing it well, you're living it. Right. You're not watching yourself. Mm-hmm. If you're watching yourself, you're not living it. You're not concentrating. But while I watch you do it, I can see. And then Mo gives you a direction, and maybe he whispers the direction to you. So now I'm trying to guess the adjustment you're making. And maybe he'll choose to tell me, or you'll choose to tell me as a fellow actor or person that's in the room. And maybe you won't, because maybe the nature of it is to be private, which is a very important thing that you feel and learn from actors. What is private? And anything that happens, when you walk in a room in a rehearsal period and you meet somebody for the first time, or you're filming something, you start to make a comment. You know, your relationship, your history as an actor, your backstory starts from high, from walking in the room. And if I start that conversation off by saying to you, you know, I hope you're thinking of doing it this way, or you're not going to say this because I have thought of, what I'm working on is this. Mm-hmm. Well, I just destroyed all the possibilities of the relationship. Well, how about shut up, man? And who is this person that you're with? And say hello. And is he overt or shy? And what gifts does he bring to the table? And what are his thoughts about how the scene is played? And why don't you just shut up and listen, just like you do when you go to a dinner party. Mm-hmm. And you meet somebody, and it's because you're quiet that you then go, God, I'd love to have dinner with that guy again who shared their life with you. Spencer Tracy always said, his favorite parts were the ones with the fewest lines, because he listened.
What a fabulous listener.
Watch Inherit the Wind.
Inherit the Wind. Mm-hmm. He's remarkable in that.
Watch him listen. Yeah. It's deafening.
Mm-hmm. I hope you guys are having as much fun.
I know. I just want to do this. Can we just do this all night long?
I got nothing.
I've learned more just in the last hour than I ever knew.
Well, I love talking about this stuff, but doing it is like climbing Everest. Mm-hmm. And you have to constantly condition yourself by what altitudes you're at, et cetera, and where how you train for it. Even if you've learned the language, words are cheap.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, my brother-in-law, who's a Zen Buddhist monk, has a beautiful saying that I think so relates to acting. I always tell acting students, not on a proselytizing nature, but the best book I ever read for acting was by Sunuru Suzuki, a Buddhist monk, called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It's a little tiny gray paperback book. I've read it 1,000 times. Each chapter is a page or a page and a half. Mm-hmm. And it is one of the most extraordinary books about humanity and life and how we are with each other. And my brother-in-law made a comment once when he was blessing the food at the dinner table before we ate. And he said, our actions, and I hear the word action, that's the whole thing, you know, for an actor. Right. And he said, my Zen Buddhist brother-in-law monk said to all of us at the table, our actions are the ground we walk.
So my next question for you would be, if you could have given yourself, from what you know now, advice to yourself when you were working, say, here in Creed, what is one thing that you would have told yourself to have made the journey easier?
I would have asked myself to try not to beat myself up for thinking that I didn't achieve whatever I meant to achieve. And that if I experienced a painful moment in my work or my relationships, to try to stay with that pain, not find excuses to escape it, not ask people to pat me on the back or give me applause or cuddle me, to let me live with the discomfort so that I could teach myself that I had more freedom than I ever understood to fail and make mistakes. that it was as much a part of succeeding, that success is equal to.
Man, you're fucking brilliant. I
love these thoughts, but boy, trying to do them is.
I meditate.
I meditate every day for 30 minutes. Part of that meditation is just to concentrate on my breathing and to try to relax. Mm-hmm. Part of it is to try to, if some of these kinds of thoughts come into my mind, to try to remember them or let them just be there so that during the day's work or the day's imagination or whatever, that if I encounter it, that, you know, I spent 5 minutes trying to be my own teacher.
Yeah, I love the, I just want to go back to the Zen Buddhist monk phrase, the walking on the ground of your actions.
Yeah. Our actions are the ground we walk on.
Our actions are the ground we walk on. And I think what you're also talking about there is just the, and the even the meditation practice is just the is the practice of it. You know,
it's the old joke, how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Right.
And that's right. What film and television don't embrace.
Right.
It might be to the case for the director or the editor who get to practice endless edits or endless preparation.
Right.
But the nature of practice is not, in my opinion, endemic to the filming practice.
Right.
Sometimes it actually helps to just get that first take, first shot out. Because once you start doing it, then you're repeating it. You're repeating it from different angles, et cetera, and you're trying to repeat rather than create.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Zen Buddhism refers to the practice of sitting as your practice, just like Isaac Stern practices to go to Carnegie Hall. Mm-hmm. We practice to put on our play. We sleep on it. Anybody with wisdom will say to you, don't make a decision when you're upset or exhausted. If you can, sleep on it for a day or more. In the same way that the play, your sleep is part of your practice. It has a gestation period in you. It changes. You come back and realize what you were doing the day before. And with the other actor was, I saw what you were doing yesterday. And I my mind doesn't work as fast as yours. And so I need to sleep on it. And then I'm more relaxed tomorrow. And it's actually metamorphosized itself to a different degree in tonight's performance than what you did last night. And now I'm more relaxed, and I don't know how it will affect me, but it wasn't untrue last night that it stopped me, frightened me, or put me on tilt, or derailed me. That was genuine.
Mm-hmm.
So tonight, maybe it'll be a different thing. And they're all valid. But it's all part of practicing. So that in the end, I think deadlines are great. And if we do need to record it or film it, or have an opening night when, you know, or this fundraiser's coming, this person who might be a wonderful funder. I want to touch that person. I hope my work has paid off for tonight so that they'll be affected and want to support our work. Well, you know, as part of your prayers, your wishes, et cetera, but if you've practiced and then if you've found a way to relax and stay available, you know, you have as good a chance as any of us have of getting it right half the time. Nobody gets it right all the time. You know, a wonderfully brilliant friend of mine uses baseball as his analogy for everything. He's a great musician and is responsible for many great musicians. He nurtures them and records them. But baseball to him is it. That game, you know, how the greatest hitters strike out. You know, the littlest thing, all of a sudden, you know, boom, man.
Yeah.
You're 6-1 in the World Series, and then the other team goes 7 in a row, and the nature of confidence and everything. Watch those athletes. Watch what happens to confidence. Do you think it's any different for an actor? And is that confidence false or real because they hear applause? Does that applause make me do better or worse?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the most beautiful moment for me always in a play is before the critics come because the audiences are unencumbered. They haven't been told what to think.
Right.
The actors are unencumbered. They haven't been told that it's wonderful or bad.
Right.
And then, you know, then you open. Then it's either a disaster and everybody's angry and they're pissed they paid the money. You're pissed that you've been, you know, beaten up. Now you have to all recover. And in general, I find it takes 3 weeks till the reviews have wrapped enough fish that, you know, that the audience has come in clean again with their own thinking that they've exhausted what they've been told. And that you as actors have healed yourself too. And to stop, you know, that, you know, told me, you know, they told these people to hate us before they even saw what we were doing. You know, it's a very rough, real part of the game.
Mm-hmm. What do you do outside of when you're on stage or performing for film or television that has nothing to do with that, that you believe supports and bolsters you. You've already mentioned meditation. Is there anything else that you do that you feel?
I exercise every day for at least 1 hour. I do aerobic work, and I believe it makes a change. I make a health drink every day that, you know, just has ground flax, Arctic cod liver oil, blueberries, palm juice, and orange juice in it, and greens, and a tablespoon Arctic cod liver oil. I have that every day. I do whatever I can to try to make my being, my body, my machine, my instrument healthy. This is what I need. If I put on a couple extra pounds, as I have at this moment, and I have to go do a concert, you know, 3, 4, 5 pounds, man, I know it. It's like all of a sudden putting an elephant on my back. And how some of these opera singers do it, that, you know, have this classic, although I think it's changed over time. It's not, yeah. Used to be 50 years ago, they were all obese. Huge, yeah. Now there's certain greater health consciousness to it. But I try to stay healthy. I take hikes every weekend. I come to places like Creed to walk around, to be inspired by the wilderness, by the size of it, by the insignificance of me, to get my ego back in shape. You know, because your ego gets all crazy. You go to airports, you're in a bad mood, you know, you're on television, people start talking, they love you, they this, they that, you know. And it, well, who? What are you talking about? Who am I? Where am I in all of this? And where you are is that little person walking in the wilderness with this place that's been here for millions of years and this overwhelming beauty, and you're here for a second. And you start to become aware of time, and you get a call this morning that a dear old friend passed away, and you go, well, how much time do I have left? And what will my kids do? And will I do another play or make another song? Or will I create anymore? You know, what's the cost of that creation? How do I balance that cost with my nature, my emotions? How do I survive it? And you talk to friends, and then your friend says, I'm going through the same thing in a different way. And you realize you're not alone. And I say, particularly to young people, and this is very important, that we are all members of a family of people that aren't any better than anyone else. But the way we happen to have been made, for better or worse, is with a higher sensitivity to human condition. Whether you're a painter, writer, musician, artist, we have a higher sensitivity. Sometimes that makes people want to take their own lives because they can't bear what humanity does to other humanity because they're so sensitive. It is that equal sensitivity that also makes them great artists, because they can infuse and osmosize it into poetry and into metaphor and into lesson and into light. And what I say to myself every day and to all young people that I meet is it's very possible that in this community of us that are called so-called artists, some of us might become very despondent or dark or depressed. There's a whole history of the great ones who couldn't function well or took their lives. Yeah. It may happen. Don't be so freaked out about it if it happens. It's not that different from a sinus cold. Call your friend. Call me. Call a teacher. Share it with someone. Don't feel you have to live alone with it. It's part of the beast that you are. It's part of your gift. And don't be so frightened of it. Don't ever take your own life. And know that it is just because you're made more sensitive. You're not better for it. You're not worse for it. It's like brown eyes, blonde hair, black hair, blue eyes. It's just what you are. And be less frightened of it. And sometime watch, if you have a minute, on National Geographic, I think, watch The Dog Whisperer. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, I like it.
It's amazing. Watch what he does with animals. Animals who have difficulty, who have anger, who are frightened, who are neurotic, who behave often like artists. And watch how he helps modify their behavior and make them freer, calmer, more available to their lifetime. It's pretty amazing.
There is, at least among people my age or these days, talk about theater. There's a lot of death talk about theater. Theater's dying, it's wearing out, it's going down, and theaters are closing. All of this. Where do you see theater going?
I began in the theater. I then had accidents happen that took me into different areas of different venues of the performing arts, whether it be recording or television or film. And my truest desire is to die on stage in the theater in the middle of a performance.
No kidding.
That's the only part of death I want to experience. I want to be in a play in the imagined world that I feel more comfortable in than my own world. I accept that. My own world's not so bad, but I like the make-believe world better. That's why I went there. Mm-hmm. And I think anyone who says the theater's dead is stupid and blind and foolish and has no wisdom. I think it is the absolute gold standard for communication. And when it's great, there's nothing that can touch it. And it's not often great. Mm-hmm. So I say this to myself, you know, I have to find the courage. It's been a while since I've been back in a play and stuff. And one loses courage. I'll have to find the strength. Maybe I'll come back here, you know. And I use the excuse that I'm busy doing a television show. I'm busy doing this. Those are excuses for someone like me. Because I really grew up in the theater. And it is what I learned. And the classics are what I know. And it's what I really... You can say there are no shoulds or shouldn'ts. There are. Mm-hmm. For certain people at a certain point. You shouldn't eat strawberries. You'll have... You'll start to choke to death and die. If you're allergic to bees, you shouldn't get stung. You know, there are things you learn that are your shouldn'ts. You shouldn't stay away from the theater that long. You'll become too frightened to go back to it because it is scary at times. And so I try to keep connected by doing concerts, but it's not enough. And you know, I got a few years left to do what I'm doing now, and then I'll have no excuses left.
Amongst, and I'll end with this, there are a lot of my friends now that are going out and starting their own companies and their own theaters and trying to start something new. What advice would you give to them in this, in their endeavors? I've got friends in San Francisco that are starting.
You know. As soon as you get the theater up and going, please call me.
It's easy to get in touch with me. Give me a job.
That's what my and you know, and what I always said, you don't let anybody tell you no. Don't let anybody tell you you can't. You can. And that's back to my friend Bob, you know, who said, you know, what you feel when you're 19, 18, or 20, 21. That's what you want to feel when you're 101. What you're feeling now, that you can create a theater and get a place and you don't have a nickel in your pocket and you can get some people to come. 42 years ago now, that started in Creed, Colorado. And it was this year named the most successful or the best regional theater in the country. Best, you know, there's other plenty good ones too. But it got the prize this year. 42 years later, it's never stopped. You know, from 12 kids from the University of Kansas, 100 letters were sent out by the JCs of a small mining town looking to fill an empty building. These kids came and it never stopped. And it gave me my foundation for my future. And I clearly can't stop coming back to the place, to the theater, because this is where I'm 18. And I take it with me wherever I go. So, you know, it's a thrilling time that, you know, you want to, and I mean it, call me, please call me.
Manny Patinkin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank you for listening. If you'd like to find out more about Creed Repertory Theater, you can visit us on the web at www.creedrep.org.